I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. We now know, because of Edward Snowden's leaks, that the NSA has been collecting phone records of millions of Americans and tapping servers of internet companies looking for suspicious email, video chats, and documents from foreign countries. We also learned that British and American intelligence agencies monitored email and phone calls of world leaders meeting in London in 2009. Army General Keith Alexander, director of the NSA, told a House committee that surveillance helped to thwart more than 50 terrorist events in more than 20 countries. We asked Sebastian Rotella, senior reporter for ProPublica and award-winning foreign correspondent, to join us. He covers international security and has been writing about the European reaction to the revelations about NSA surveillance, the relationship between American and European intelligence agencies, and the case of David Coleman Headley. And Sebastian Rotella, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. You're joining us from Spain. What has been the reaction in Europe to revelations about NSA and surveillance?
Well, there's two different kinds of reactions on the part of the public and some people in politics. I think there's a certain amount of concern and even some indignation about this idea that that people thinking that there is at least a potential for the NSA to be spying on them, since the internet program in particular is particularly targets foreigners. But I've been talking to people in the counterterrorism community, and it's interesting there because they are much more familiar with these programs and their investigations have benefited from them a great deal. I've covered quite a few many cases over the past decade in Europe where you had a combination of U.S. high-tech intelligence gathering and European human sources that was, you know, very effective teamwork against different cases where you had people in Europe involved in plots with masterminds and training camps back in Pakistan and communications back and forth. So it's interesting to see that there's less sort of there's almost like surprise that this is such big news and people sort of in the community kind of took it more for granted.
But would it be fair to say that the American approach is more about data mining and the European approach is more about human intelligence?
It's obviously we don't want to oversimplify. Americans also use human sources, and Europeans also use some technological means. But there's no doubt that the great emphasis, particularly when it comes to Islamic terrorism, the great emphasis of the Europeans has been, because they have big communities and ongoing threats that have been around for decades, and also a lack of resources. They just don't have the kind of technology and the kind of resources that the U.S. has to invest in technology. The European front has been much more about getting to know those communities, about lots and lots of human sources. The balance is much more about street-level spying. And on the U.S. side, certainly I think the strength of U.S. intelligence gathering is in these cases, being able to gather these enormous amounts of information and having global reach. The problem that the Europeans see, while they appreciate that, is that sometimes they think the Americans are so focused on just sheer quantity of information that the analysis and the ability to, or the practice of developing human sources, sometimes suffers on the American side.
And do you think the U.S. reliance on secrecy, something that we have learned in the last couple of weeks, does that also affect the kind of intelligence sharing between the U.S. and its European counterparts?
There have been times, yes, where I think the Europeans feel that there may have been an overreaction to the threat of Islamic terrorism and a rigidity and aggressiveness to put everything, the secret label on everything, to the extent that a European investigator told me an anecdote where he told an American counterpart, shared some intelligence from a case he was working in Europe, and then had a subsequent conversation where his American counterpart said some things that led the European to think that there had been some faulty analysis or misunderstanding of the information he had given him. And he said, listen, we need to go over a couple other things because what you're telling me I'm a little concerned about. And the American, according to my source, said, I can't talk to you about it now. It's a secret. And he said, well, but it's information you got from us. And he said it didn't matter. So there's a sense that sometimes the secrecy may go a bit far.
We're talking about Europe as if it's one big country, although there's some sort of truth to that. But nonetheless, what are the laws about things like wiretapping? I mean, how different are they from what we might have in the United States, or even data mining?
And of course, you put your point out very rightly, where Europe is shorthand for countries with very different cultures. But certainly we're talking about the big European countries, the British, the French, the Spanish, the Italians. In France, for example, in Italy, I think there's a great acceptance and sort of tolerance of very aggressive, say in France, a very aggressive grid of domestic espionage. In Italy, there was a point a couple of years ago where I think the figure was 112,000 phone lines were being tapped. It's very hard to use undercover officers and informants like we do in the States, but it's comparatively easy on judicial basis to tap somebody's phone. So there are certainly everyone has in a lot of these countries there are very robust domestic spying, domestic espionage apparatuses, no matter what they may say about their concerns about privacy and American spying on them.
But would it be fair to say that terrorism is a bigger threat in Europe than it is in the United States?
Well, I mean, I would certainly say, you know, it's hard to compare, and there's certainly a threat in the United States because the U.S. is, you know, a number one target. But if you think about it, Europe has much bigger Muslim communities. It has much bigger proportionate, even in small countries like Denmark or Belgium, extremist populations. It has a longer history of attacks, and it is closer to the lands of jihad. In other words, it's closer to Syria, where a lot of people are going to fight now. It's closer to Pakistan. It's closer to Mali. It's closer to the places where a lot of the training and a lot of the radicalization, either happens physically or those causes effects. So I would say the threat is probably greater, yes, and closer.
You also wrote that the U.S. does, frankly, a better job of integrating Muslims, if that's what we're talking about, Muslims into our larger culture than some European countries.
I think that's true. I mean, I think, again, I hate to generalize, but I've spent enough time comparing, I think, traveling and looking at this in Europe and the States and looking at questions of migration and integration and particularly of Muslim communities that yes, I think, though the approach is very different in Britain, say, compared to France, in general, I think the Europeans have struggled with integrating their Muslim communities, and I think that's something the U.S. still does pretty well. And you see that in Europe because you have a lot, not just people involved in extremism, but people who are not at all involved in extremism, but you have, you know, working and poorer classes that of Muslim descent, you know, and that also plays a role there, too. So I think, yes, I think that's one thing the U.S., as imperfect as other things may be, does quite well, is integrate immigrants in general and Muslims in particular.
Would you say that these revelations about NSA in any way sort of colored the president's trip to Europe this week?
Certainly in the press coverage, there was some... there were comments about it, and there were concerns about it, and people are focusing on it. I don't know if it's as big a deal here as it is there, but certainly there was some of the coverage was a bit maybe saying ironic. You know, here's the Americans coming to talk to us about liberty and freedom when this kind of thing is going on. But I don't think it's been a huge distraction in Europe, no.
And that's Sebastian Rattel, a senior reporter for ProPublica, award-winning foreign correspondent, and the first of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, getting a kind of a catch-up and three perspectives on the revelations about NSA and surveillance. As I said in my introduction, Army General Keith Alexander, who's now the director of the NSA, told the House committee that surveillance had helped to thwart more than 50 terrorists, and I'm using quotations here, events in more than 20 countries. You've written about a guy named David Coleman. It's a complicated story, but is there a shorthand version of who he was or who he is?
David Coleman Headley actually was someone who had spent some time in Philadelphia. He's a Pakistani-American who, by virtue of being fluent in both languages and connected in both cultures, becomes a drug trafficker and then a DEA informant and then a top undercover surveillance operative for a Pakistani terrorist group and for Pakistani intelligence. And he does the very important and meticulous surveillance for the attacks in 2008 in Mumbai, India, where 166 people were killed using his cover as an American businessman to scout hotels and other things. And then he's caught as he's trying to do a follow-up attack in Denmark against the newspaper that had published the cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. The case has been held up by the NSA and other government officials as an example of where these programs worked well. They say that these programs helped stop the Denmark attack. What we did in some stories was try and show that was... It's not the best example. It's an imperfect example. The problem is that number one, Headley, neither high-tech nor human sources were able to stop Headley for 6 years as he was training and radicalizing and doing this surveillance, even though there were repeated warnings to U.S. agencies about him that he was a terrorist and involved in this kind of stuff, yet the Mumbai attacks happened anyway. And even that Denmark plot, what hasn't been mentioned in some of the public descriptions of it is that it was really a British tip that first turned that made the Americans aware of Headley, and then, of course, the whole full might of U.S. agencies, including the NSA, was turned on him and helped build the case against him and prevent that plot. But it's been held up as a shining success story, and I just think that's respectfully think that that's not completely accurate.
Well, and from your reporting, what's interesting is that some of the people who were warning federal agents were two wives of him and members of his own family.
That's right. I mean, it's a remarkable litany of errors where the system doesn't do what it was supposed to do, what all that effort was spent after 9/11 to fix, which is so you have, say, the FBI in Pennsylvania and the FBI and people at an embassy in Islamabad and people in FBI in New York getting different warnings from different people at the same times about much the same activity that is training in Pakistan and later suspicious travel and things like that. Yet the system not communicating, you know, the different threats not being all being put together to realize, hey, there's something really serious going on here. And again, what's remarkable is that afterward, when he was arrested and the case was being built against him, the investigators went back and got a lot of NSA security intercepts of him communicating with known Al-Qaeda, Lashkar-e-Taiba, which is a terrorist group, and Pakistani intelligence masterminds. Yet none of those intercepts obviously played a role earlier in detecting the threat from him. So it's really it's kind of a case study of how the system shouldn't work in a lot of ways.
These those kind of famous silos that we hear about in intelligence agencies, which is just one part doesn't necessarily talk to another part of the agency?
I think that's right, and I think that's one of the things that's happened, you know, with this, one of the things in this conversation we're having about the NSA is this problem that the government sometimes doesn't know what it knows. In other words, we have the capacity to suck up all this information, to this sheer volume of information, but sometimes there's an inability to analyze it properly, or to even, if it's in a foreign language, to interpret it, or to use it in a timely fashion. So I think, yeah, there's a problem with that. It's not always a question of having the information, mm-hmm. but understanding it.
But should we question when the head of the NSA says that this surveillance helped to thwart more than 50 terrorist events? Should we question that, having talked about David Coleman Headley?
I think we should want to know more about what that means when we say stop and when we say terrorist, whatever the word is, attacks or activities or events. I do think, and I don't want to minimize, because I have seen firsthand that this kind of intelligence gathering can and has intercept plots, so I don't want to minimize that. But I do think we should push for within the bounds of secrecy and all that, more detail and more explanation. Because again, in the case of Headley, it's technically true to say that these programs help stop a plot, but it's not true to it leaves the impression that he was discovered because of these programs, and that just doesn't sound right. And again, these programs failed to discover him for a good 4 to 5 years. So it's so I think I'm not saying that that's I'm saying I do think these programs have been shown to be effective, but it's easy to sort of to say in a superficial way that they've been great successes in stopping attacks, and then when you dig a little deeper, it becomes a little more gray and a little more complicated than that.
Well, Sebastian Rotella, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. And he's a senior reporter for ProPublica, telling us about how the NSA works with its European counterparts. Tim Chirok, Waiting in the Wings, author of Spies for Hire, helped to uncover the outsourcing of intelligence gathering to private companies. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Man supports WHYY and presents a Jerry Garcia Symphonic Celebration featuring Warren Haynes and the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra with the Joshua Light Show this Tuesday, June 25th. Warren Haynes of the Dead, Allman Brothers, and Government Mule fame plays Garcia's most prized guitar, Wolf, this Tuesday evening at The Man. Tickets are available online at mancenter.org or by phone at 215-893-1999.
I'm John Hockenberry of The Takeaway. The Takeaway is a fast-paced look at the news of the day. It's in-the-moment conversations that take the facts and frame them in ways that make you think. Newsmakers, experts, and people affected by the news, all part of the conversation. The talk is better when there's more at stake. So listen to The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Beginning July 2nd at noon on WHYY.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Paul Feig's career path has been rocky. The first two studio films he directed were far from successful. So, when it came time to make Bridesmaids, the stakes were high.
All through that movie, I just kept referring to it as Strike 3. You know, because I just knew it's either going to work or I'm going to literally be just 6 feet under after this thing.
Paul Feig and I talk about that movie and his new one, The Heat, on the next Bullseye from NPR.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. One thing we now know about the NSA and its surveillance program is that many of its responsibilities are performed by private companies, not by analysts working for the federal government. Edward Snowden, who leaked the NSA documents, worked for Booz Allen Hamilton. James Clapper was a Booz Allen executive before he became the Obama administration's chief intelligence officer. His predecessor in the Bush administration, John McClellan, works now for Booz Allen. Our guest, Tim Shorrock, is the author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing, which was published about 5 years ago. He's been writing about privatizing intelligence for a number of publications, including Salon, The Nation, and Mother Jones. And Tim Shorrock, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Tim, what is Booz Allen Hamilton?
Well, it's a big consulting company. It's been around for many years, since the 30s, essentially. But during World War II and afterwards, it became very big in contracting management services to various units of the U.S. military, and it's grown over time into a major intelligence contractor. So now it's one of the largest contractors in what I call the intelligence industrial complex. And it makes about, it makes 99% of its revenue from U.S. government contracts. So the line between private and public is pretty thin. Let me just correct one thing you said. It was Michael McConnell, who was the Booz Allen executive, who's now still at Booz, who was the director of national intelligence for Bush. Before that, he was with Booz. Before that, he was director of the NSA. So this is a spinning door we have now between government and the private sector.
And thank you for that correction, and which, as you say, the door even spins even faster. But what do we know? We know now what Edward Snowden was doing when he was working for Booz Allen. But what kind of responsibilities do the people who work at Booz Allen? What do they do for the federal government, for NSA?
Well, they do anything that an intelligence officer does, and they work across all the agencies. They are a major private sector contractor at the NSA, but they also work for CIA. They work for all parts of the U.S. military and the Pentagon at very high levels. If you go on their website, you will see, you know, they provide, you know, advice to the Office of Director of National Intelligence and the Assistant the Secretary of Defense for Intelligence. So they're at very high levels. Mr. Snowden was not, but it just shows you here this more or less low level person had access to incredible documents, highly secret documents from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court and from NSA's surveillance of the internet. So, you know, they operate at all levels, basically. So anything you can imagine an intelligence agency doing, they're doing it.
But why have these responsibilities been outsourced to private companies? Why isn't the federal government doing this? Can they not find the right kind of analysts, for instance?
Well, let's start with today's news, which is people probably read or heard about last night that a company called USIS is being investigated for mishandling the security clearances of Edward Snowden for the NSA and for Booz Allen. So it came as a surprise to a lot of people that this company, USIS, was a contractor, doing security clearances for agencies. Well, actually, in my book, as I reported a few years ago, USIS was actually created during the Clinton administration, when the Clinton administration privatized a huge number of agencies, including the Office of Personnel Management's investigative unit that did security clearances for the government. And that was sold to the Carlyle Group, a major private equity fund, and they took this company USIS private, sold it a few years ago, and so I think, you know, Congress may be looking into these problems with USIS, but I think they should ask themselves why a company like this was outsourced in the first place, why this function was outsourced. And I would also add that Carlyle Group is also the primary owner of Booz Allen Hamilton. So you can see how deep these connections go.
Well, but was the thought to, what, save money by outsourcing some of these programs or these services?
Well, you know, as I've been explaining, this process began long before 9/11 and the huge uptick in intelligence spending that happened after that. But, you know, basically, you know, in the late 1990s, under particularly under President Clinton, there was a huge amount of outsourcing that happened, and the idea was the government did not need to be in certain kinds of businesses. And, you know, so, you know, this particular agency was privatized, sold whole to a private company. And then, you know, the agencies started going to private sector companies in the 1990s, partly because the personnel roles and budgets at major agencies like NSA had been slashed after the Cold War, and so a lot of the sort of institutional knowledge, shall we say, went to the private sector, and when there was a need for intelligence, they would go to these companies. And then after 9/11, there was a huge increase in intelligence spending. They just poured money into NSA and CIA and other agencies, and rather than build up a government cadre of officers, they privatized and outsourced many of these tasks. And so you have, you know, virtually all functions being privatized. And I found a document, obtained a document when I was doing my book in 2007, showing that 70%, that's 70% of U.S. intelligence spending goes to the private sector. And going by today's estimated budget of $80 billion, that makes private contracting in intelligence mm-hmm. a $56 billion business. And I would say it's probably a lot larger than that.
So if someone is now working at the NSA, let's say you're an analyst there, what are you doing if most of this has been privatized?
Well, you know, I'd say the NSA, you know, maybe 40-50% of the actual personnel are working actually for private companies. A few days ago, General Alexander, the director of NSA, mentioned that 12 years ago, its internal IT at NSA was outsourced, and that went to a large consortium of companies that were running, you know, like NSA's, you know, internal communication between offices and between NSA outposts and that kind of thing. And apparently, he also said that Snowden was working on that program, which is how we got access to this. So it's clear that it's possible for, you know, private companies to get access to a huge amount of personal information that NSA is tracking about you and I and everybody else in the United States. I mean, essentially, what in privatizing NSA's collection of intelligence, they turned what was supposed to be foreign intelligence onto the United States. I mean, you know, the laws that it operates under, it's called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, foreign intelligence, and they turn that on us, and now they're doing dragnet surveillance of basically, you know, the entire population by getting these call records and other from Verizon, AT&T, and other companies, and then by trolling the internet.
Does anyone know, I mean, so much of this is secret, but does anyone know what these private companies are doing with that information? I mean, are they trading it, selling it with other private companies, or are they responsible to keep that secret and to share it with the federal government?
Well, no, they're responsible for only, you know, the work they do under contract to this that specific agency, and there are certainly, you know, rules and all kinds of regulations internally put in to make sure that kind of leakage doesn't happen. But I think that, you know, this case shows that you know, I mean, all it takes is, you know, one person to, you know, to leak and get access to this and to leak it. And so, you know, there's certainly a danger of having so much outsourced to private companies. I mean, you know, literally, apparently the latest numbers I've seen, it's about 500,000 people, 500,000 or so, that are contractors who have top secret security clearances. And that's just the top secret clearances. So there are thousands of people, you know, basically, you know, that have access to information about the rest of us. And I think that's an untenable situation.
And that's Tim Sharrock, our second of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. He wrote a book a couple of years ago called Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. He's been writing about privatizing intelligence for a number of publications, as I mentioned, Salon, The Nation, Mother Jones, among others. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We'd be curious about your reaction to the privatizing of some of this intelligence as we have been talking about. Do you think, and the reaction in Congress has varied, I think, depending on who you're talking to, but it seems that some members of Congress have been shocked to learn about the privatizing of intelligence. Should they be?
Well, no, it's kind of ironic because here's people that had oversight over the intelligence community for years, and they're saying they're surprised by this. I had an article, an op-ed in the New York Times on Tuesday where, you know, the first people I quoted were Senator Dianne Feinstein, who's the chairperson of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and Nancy Pelosi, who was the House Speaker during all this time when intelligence was built up and much of it was privatized, you know, both saying, you know, expressing surprise that so much is outsourced. Well, they know darn well how much it's been. Congress has completely failed its oversight responsibility. They've held, you know, just a couple of hearings since this enormous growth in private sector intelligence that's really grown hugely since 2001, and you know they have not investigated this. There was a hearing yesterday finally on security clearances, and that's where this news came out that this company USIS was being investigated. Mm-hmm. But they have not gone into this, and you know the agency's answer to them. The problem is, you know, intelligence contractors are not in the line of authority at any of these agencies. They're not under congressional oversight. They report to their contract officer within the agency, and their loyalty is to their company and their shareholders, and they want more contracts. They want to get more business. This is a business. They make profit out of it. They lobby. They try to get more work out of these agencies. And I think placing so much faith in these companies to, you know, to sort of please do the right thing is wrong. And you know, the American people need to be aware of the high level of intelligence that these companies provide for different agencies.
And I do want to get to our callers. Let me just quote something from Senator Feinstein, who said most recently that she wants to limit or prevent contractors from handling classified data. Do you think, as a result of these revelations, that Congress will provide more oversight or limit who can handle some of this classified information?
I would hope they would have some more oversight, and they've said they will. But you can bet that the contractors, which have an enormous lobby here in Washington, you can bet that they will be lobbying very hard against that. And my sense is they will probably win out. This would be the lifeblood of these companies to have, you know, security clearances. I mean, they're commodities. You get a security clearance when you're in government, and that's your calling card to get a high paying job. And many of these jobs in intelligence contracting pay 2 to 3 times what people make in government. And so that's one of the lures, is big money. And there is big money to be made. There are billions and billions of dollars sloshing around these agencies. And much of the time, you know, agencies are, you know, the companies are actually advising these agencies on how to spend that money. Mm-hmm. It's a built-in conflict of interest. And I think Congress has its work cut out for it if they're actually going to look at this.
Let me get, looks like Dan from Winmore to join our conversation. Dan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
It sounds like there's two problems here. One is the private contractors handling sensitive material, and also the added cost. So it seems like privatization that started under Reagan has, you know, snowballed, and we've got two problems here. compounded by the lobbying problem. So how do we get around this? I mean, you know, campaign finance reform has failed. And the second thing is did President Clinton become a member of Carlisle after he was president?
Dan, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You know the answer to that, Tim?
No, he did not. But I mean, there have been plenty of, you know, very senior leaders from the U.S. government have gone into there. I mean, for a long time, George Bush Sr., the former president, was a member of its advisory board and did actually a lot of work in attracting investments in Carlisle and went around the world representing Carlisle. James Baker, who served many Republican presidents, was also a key player there. But, you know, getting back to the first, you know, yes. issues he brought up, I think that yes, the costs are added. I mean, these congressional committees could go quite deeply into looking at how these companies operate, but also this what I call the spinning door. I mean, right now the only law that limits them is a 1-year ban on lobbying. And after you leave the government. And that's not much. I mean, a lot of these people, when they go into these companies, they do some lobbying, but they don't lobby. They sit on the board of directors. And basically, you know, they provide advice on where, you know, where the spending is going to happen in their agency that they just left. And they have the contacts. You know, if you're a high level CIA official, like, say, George Tenet, who has gone on to some of these companies, the phrase is, you know, where the bodies are buried, but you also know where the spending is going to happen over the next 5 or 10 years. You're extremely valuable to these companies in saying, well, you know, CIA may spend here, this is where they're interested in contracting, this is where they may not have enough people, and so on. And so, you know, they become part of a large class of people that we have that have no oversight over, and yet, you know, operate at very high levels. And I think that's where Congress really needs to step in and you know put some limits. There used to be a 5-year limit, 5-year ban on lobbying, but I think there needs to be a lot more than that.
Well, and Dan talked about sensitive material, and Tim, would it be fair to say that some of these contractors know more than members of Congress when it comes to some of the sensitive material?
Well, they certainly do know more than Congress. I mean, they have access to, you know, the highly sensitive, top secret, classified information on the various operations, you know, they're working on. You know, people may remember a controversy during the Bush administration over something called the Total Information Systems, and the Total Information was a project by Admiral Poindexter from Iran-Contra days to basically scoop up, you know, have the U.S. intelligence scoop up huge amounts of not only, you know, phone and internet data, but, you know, personal information, buying habits, credit card records, phone, you know, all kinds of information that would tell, it could add to profiles of people. And Congress was upset about this, and actually some people were horrified, and they ordered this program, Total Information Awareness, it was called, shut down. But then, actually Booz Allen stepped in. They were given some of the contracts for this, and they were buried under other contracts. So the work continued, even though, you know, Congress had said it should not. So, you know, I think maybe there needs to be some oversight over Congress, too, because they're just simply, you know, not up to this. I mean, it's grown so huge. I mean, this, you know, $56 billion private intelligence industry, that's a big industry. That's as big as the GNP of Norway. So, you know, there's a lot to oversee there, and I think lots more needs to be done.
Well, Tim Shorrock, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's been writing about privatizing intelligence for a number of publications, including Salon, The Nation, Mother Jones. Wrote a book a couple of years ago titled Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. We have another guest, our third guest, waiting in the wings, and we have some open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The New Jersey Pharmacists Association supports WHYY, representing pharmacists in the state of New Jersey in all practice settings. NJPHA works to advance the profession of pharmacy and raises the profile of pharmacists. NJPHA provides state legislative representation, leadership opportunities, continuing education, and more. NJPHA's annual convention is October 3rd through 5th at Trump Taj Mahal. More details at njpharmacist.info or 609-275-4246.
On the next Fresh Air, neurologist Oliver Sacks talks about hallucinations and how they can be triggered by grief, trauma, brain injury, medications, and neurological disorders. And he'll tell us about his personal experimentation with hallucinogenic drugs in the 60s. His book, Hallucinations, is coming out in paperback. Join us. This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY. I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. President Obama will formally nominate Jim Comey, formerly of the Bush administration, to be his next FBI director. What will that mean for secret surveillance programs? Also, the original guitar hero John McLaughlin, out with what he calls his best album yet. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Well, not everyone is a critic of the NSA surveillance program. Joining us now is David Barrett. He's a professor of political science at Villanova University. He's written extensively about the CIA and Congress, the author of a number of books, including most recently one called Blind Over Cuba, co-authored with Max Holland. And David Barrett, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. It's great talking to you again.
Well, I know that you have been listening in to our previous guests, and I just want to pick up on what Tim Sharrock was talking about the privatization of intelligence agencies. Does that concern you as much as it does him?
It probably doesn't concern me as much as it does him, but I, you know, I'm not the biggest fan of the extensive amount of privatization of intelligence. My sense of it is that our government, our intelligence agencies have moved more in that direction for that. You sort of ask about this somewhat, but in terms of seeking the best possible expertise, also ironically, it is said to save money sometimes to you know, hire people by way of contractors. As your guest said, there's some pretty fancy salaries out there, but apparently there's some sort of financial appeal, some money saving appeal to that. But on the whole, like Senator Feinstein, I would be comfortable with some limits being placed on that. But I don't want us to be naive either. There's a lot of expertise out there sometimes that can be gotten most sort of efficiently through private contractors. That's my sense of it. But I understand the reasons for unease about this, and I share some of it.
Were you surprised, shocked, upset to learn the NSA has been mining phone records of Americans?
No.
Why not? Why
you know, Marty, this morning I was sort of Googling this subject matter, and your previous guest referred to this a bit, but there was a huge controversy in the Bush era. And one of the stories that came up that I looked at this morning, it sounded like it was written 2 weeks ago. It was written in 2006. It said, well, the National Security Agency is mining phone data. It made some sort of briefer reference to Internet activity. I'm not the least bit surprised that this is going on. I was assuming that National Security Agency was doing this sort of thing. I think that a person who has been following the news about this subject matter would not be shocked. And there was someone said earlier in your program that Senator Feinstein claimed to have been shocked by some aspects of the story, and I don't think that that's what she said. She did express some desire that we move somewhat back away from the privatization of intelligence, but she seems to me to typify a member of Congress. She chairs the Senate Intelligence Committee, and I'm not going to be naive and claim that all members of the House Intelligence Committee and the Senate Intelligence Committee have actively, energetically been following NSA and the other agencies, because I think we all know, anyone who sort of studies Congress knows that members of Congress are they're busy, there are too many things to do, they're worried about re-election, they don't always do an excellent job of monitoring federal agencies, but I think some of them do, and I think she's one of them.
before the, you know, the internet and data mining technology, it seemed that, you know, government agencies needed a warrant if they wanted to listen in on someone's phone calls. Now we have, of course, with just gobs and gobs of information on the internet and the way the phone systems work now, we do have the NSA, basically monitoring, not monitoring in terms of listening in, but at least data mining all that particular kind of data. Does the technology change how we should think about this?
I think that, look, there's no doubt that technology changes, it evolves, it has become more sophisticated across the decades. There's no doubt about that. But I think that Americans' privacy rights were, even though the technology was not as advanced, I think our privacy rights were violated, truly violated, with greater frequency in prior decades. If you go back to, say, mid-20th century, let's say go back to the 1950s, for example, there was very, very little sort of legal limitations placed on what government agencies were doing. And we made some progress in subsequent decades in having more, frankly, writing, passing more laws, certain court decisions, so that I think that things got better. So the quality of or the level of our privacy rights, I think, sort of waxes and wanes across, say, the last century or so. But the technology has advanced. Again, there's just no doubt about that. And I think that does make it increasingly difficult to pass appropriate laws. It is a real challenge. But I want to tell you, like, again, back in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, there were such violations. I mean, you could go back further. For example, one of the American intelligence agencies back in the Franklin Roosevelt era wiretapped, monitored the room where the First Lady, Eleanor Roosevelt, was staying. I mean, can you imagine that? Could you imagine that happening today? Actually, I don't think that would happen today, bugging the hotel room of Michelle Obama, but this happened in the Roosevelt era, bugging Mrs. Roosevelt's room. So, you know, Harry Truman used to say, there's nothing new under the sun except the history that you don't know. So when we know our history, we see these are continuing concerns. And I'm not denying these are privacy concerns. I have the concerns of some of your previous guests. But I also think, including with your most recent guests, there's a certain level of hysteria that's going on. To say that there's nothing going on in the way of congressional oversight of intelligence, it seems to me your guest said something very much like that. I think that that's just not so. It's not so. We have a president who has been aware of this activity. We have two rather large congressional committees with very substantial staffs who have been aware of and to some degree monitoring these programs. And we have this special court. So this is not some police state. I've friends of mine have expressed concerns that we're now living in a police state. We are not living in a police state.
And that's David Barrett. He's a professor of political science at Villanova University, the third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. Getting responses, reactions to revelations about NSA and surveillance, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. David, one of the criticisms of the court, the FISA court, is that it has become a rubber stamp. And even I'm looking at something the New York Times wrote recently, basically saying that the court operates in such secrecy that we don't really know what it is approving or apparently rarely not approving. Are you concerned about the rubber stamp nature of the FISA court, if that's true?
I agree that it is hard to make judgments about a court which is highly secret. But I also accept the need for there to be a good deal of secrecy about a court which is itself dealing with government intelligence activities that need to be shrouded in a good deal of secrecy. One of the problems with this, I teach a course called U.S. Intelligence at Villanova, and I say to my students, one of the problems with there are a lot of problems relating to this matter of intelligence. I mean, I think it's really in a dangerous world, having vigorous intelligence agencies and intelligence gathering programs and all that is very necessary, but they do need to be shrouded in secrecy. And then you start wondering, well, what about democracy? What about the people's right to know? So what we've evolved in our system is things like this FISA court. We have these congressional intelligence committees. And I have to acknowledge that for an ordinary citizen to know details about the functioning of this FISA court, it's something that we can have only little knowledge about. And I've seen the numbers that they usually, almost always, do approve the request set before them. But my sense of it, I don't know many people who work in the intelligence agencies. A lot of my research is historical, but I occasionally, you know, talk to people who worked recently or work currently for these intelligence agencies, and they said, you know, the FISA court is not presented with requests that a reasonable person, certainly a reasonable judge, would just say, well, this is absurd. Why are you even asking? So I think that when these requests are put before the court, a good deal of thought has been gone into it, like, shall we even make this request or not? So I suspect that it doesn't just suggest that the FISA court is a rubber stamp, or I don't know that it does suggest that, but it also is something about the quality and the reasonableness of the requests that are put before that court.
I'm looking something again in the New York Times, but as we know, the president was on the Charlie Rose program earlier this week, and he said something that speaks to what you just said there, and this, of course, having to do with how much the public should know, and he said, and I'm quoting here, the public may not fully know, and that can make the public kind of nervous, right? This is in conversation with Charlie Rose, but I guess where we are where we always are, which is this balance between secrecy and privacy and the right to know and intelligence.
Right, and this concern and these problems never go away. And I've, not just as a scholar of intelligence, but as a citizen, I feel these concerns in both directions. So let me just say, I am absolutely convinced that, you know, Al-Qaeda and affiliates, there are those out there and supporters of Al-Qaeda, there are people who wish to do harm to us here at home. I think this is a continuing problem. So I have real concerns about the security of the United States and its citizenry. But I am not thrilled with the huge amount of privatization of intelligence, because as your previous guest suggested, it's harder for Congress to oversee, to monitor the intelligence, I think, when it's done by the contractors. It's just sort of harder for them to get at it. So I do have these concerns, and I do have the concerns about NSA, just sort of the vast data mining that occurs. But again, as the president said, it's not as if NSA is simply listening to our phone calls. If they want to go to that next step beyond the data mining, the looking at, well, where was this, you know, what's the number this call was placed from, the number placed to, if they need to go that beyond that, they have to get additional permission from the court. So this gives me some kind of a reasonable comfort level. But I will say, in our country right now, to some degree, I blame the news media, to be blunt, because some of the commentary, more the commentary in the news media than the reporting, has a level of hysteria. And so I've looked at the polling that's been done of the American public, and I think many Americans really do think that NSA is literally listening to their phone calls. Again, I was speaking to a friend of mine who was very intelligent just last week, and he honestly believed that NSA had been monitoring his phone calls. And I said, I'm not going to say his name, but I said, they're not listening to your phone calls. They're not.
But you know what's so interesting and is that while there is a certain kind of reaction to the notion of the government at least monitoring or data mining some of our information, we so willingly give it away to private companies who send us things, and we go through, you know, on the highway with the easy passes and all that kind of thing. We are giving away information about ourselves all the time, and we don't seem to be particularly upset about it. But maybe it's because we're doing it rather than somebody else.
Yes, I mean that is a difference. But but what you say is true, and it's ironic. You know, just recently I got a new sort of smartphone. I had not had a smartphone before, and so I was sort of setting up it to deal with my Facebook account. And oh my goodness, all the things that you agreed to, and understanding what it is you're agreeing to. At a certain point, you just say okay, and hope for the best. Mm-hmm. So there is some irony there. But at least, as you say, we personally are agreeing to something, and I understand with NSA. you know, we're not signing a piece of paper that says, okay, NSA, you can do this. So it really, in my opinion, comes very much back to, since we citizens cannot directly monitor what NSA and the other agencies are doing, we end up relying very much on the House Intelligence Committee, the Senate Intelligence Committee, people like Senator Feinstein or Representative Mike Rogers, who's a Republican who chairs the House Intelligence Committee. They become our representatives to do that work. And I hope that out of this controversy, what emerges is an improved level and quality of congressional oversight of intelligence. I think it's been better than your previous guest said, but I have no doubt. I've studied the history of congressional monitoring of intelligence, and I have no doubt it could be made better. I want these two committees to be all over this NSA program.
Adding to that, though, is, of course, the low regard that the public holds Congress.
That's
you know,
true.
Whether there's any confidence, you know, rightly or wrongly, that Congress can provide the kind of oversight that's needed, as you describe it.
Yes. And let me just say, I'm one of those citizens who, it's not just in the current era, going back for whatever reason, maybe back to the Bill Clinton era and all the sort of scandals and controversies of that era, I've, as a citizen, sometimes feel a certain dismay about contemporary politics. And yet, for what it's worth, and I want to say this as someone who has studied these two intelligence committees, I think many, many members of these two intelligence committees take their work, their role of monitoring intelligence agencies very seriously. So I do have some regard and some faith in the work that they do. Not all the members. I mean, to be blunt, I was not thrilled when a few years ago Michelle Bachmann was placed on the House Intelligence Committee. I didn't take her to be the most serious member of the House. So, but on the whole, I think there is a level of seriousness on the part of many or a majority of those members. And really, we citizens have to rely on these two congressional committees to monitor, to see that these agencies are doing what they should do.
We're almost out of time here. Unfair question to you, David Barrett, but what do you think of Edward Snowden?
I don't have much regard for him. He reminds me, I've written another piece that I hope is going to be published soon in a certain newspaper. They tell me it'll be out in a few days. He reminds me of these two young men who in 1960 first revealed details about National Security Agency to the world. They left the country. They held a press conference, although they went to the Soviet Union, not to Hong Kong. But I think there is a level of arrogance. I think there's a level of ignorance about the American political system. So I'm not a fan.
Well, David Barrett, as always, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure, Marty. Thank you.
You're welcome. He's a professor of political science at Villanova University. Right before him, we talked with Tim Shorrock, author of Spies for Hire, and began our conversation talking with Sebastian Rotella, a senior reporter for ProPublica. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can, of course, find out much more about this program, including Facebook and Twitter, podcasts, email, archives. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.